You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson will be joining in a few moments. This hour, John and his guest are
Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Nine on Monday means it's time for All Things Political, where we take a look at the top political stories of the past week and the weekend. My guest this hour is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Good morning and welcome to the program. Lots of political news to talk about this morning. Let's start with South Carolina, Mark Sanford's announcement, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's announcement that he will not step down as governor. What's his political future looking like? Okay, we don't have our guest on with us yet. It's a typical Monday morning everywhere. Well, let me do this. The top news stories of the political news stories of the week, of course, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's announcement that he will not step down. President Obama is ramping up his pressure on Congress to get health care reform passed. The big sticking point seems to be how to pay for it. And there are a number of competing plans in the in both the House and Senate. Republicans are rejecting any offer of bipartisanship on the issue of a public health insurance option. The Obama administration got a victory in Congress when it passed climate change legislation last Friday in a close vote in the House. Now the argument is this cap and trade or cap and tax? Warren Buffett is calling it a huge tax increase, while Paul Krugman points out that the bill contains market incentives to push people away from bad energy choices. Lots of international issues to discuss, and we'll get to that. Let me give the phone numbers so that people can call in and join our discussion. Once we get it going, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, that's the toll-free number. If you'd like to join us by email, you can do that as well. The email address is 800-486-8655, excuse me, the email address is talk@wpr.org. So, we have, I believe we have Chase Martin with us now. Good morning, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Let's start with South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford's announcement that he will not step down as governor. What's his political future looking like?
Well, I think, at least I'm down here in Iowa, from the presidential campaign's point of view, I'd say that his chances at the nomination for the Republican Party in 2012 are slim to none at this point. The social conservatives here seem to dominate the Republican Party, particularly during the caucuses. And, you know, whether or not an affair is a career-ending mistake, it certainly has a half-life of more than 3 years. So it seems to me that whether or not Sanford does choose to run for higher office at some point in the future, his chances, at least in the short term, are over.
And he's certainly not. He's just the most recent of Republican presidential hopefuls to stumble or to have some kind of an issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, it was just a week earlier that Senator John Ensign, who had just made a trip down here to Iowa, had to admit to his own affair. And it seems that, you know, the Republican Party is doing some sort of a cleansing move right now, where a lot of the folks with skeletons in their closets, the skeletons seem to be coming out. Whether this is all a coincidence or something else, it's hard to say at this point, but it is interesting. And, you know, we are very early now getting a clearer and clearer picture of which candidates are going to be lining up to run for president in 2012 just simply by the process of elimination. So it's definitely interesting. You know, it's going to be interesting to watch over the next few years.
It's I guess it's it just seems to be a little early to be talking about 2012, but we're already doing it, and that's kind of the way these things are going now. We have the continuous cycle. Well, let's switch to some other political news. President Obama is ramping up pressure on Congress to get health care reform passed. Congress seems to be having trouble figuring out how to pay for it. Lots of competing plans, some accusations that bipartisanship has disappeared. I don't know if it ever was there, but the sticking point seems to be how to pay for President Obama's health care plan. He has said that he wants it to be basically revenue neutral, that it won't increase the size of the deficit. Pretty hard to do that if you don't find some way to cover the cost. And David Axelrod says that they're not they aren't ruling out the idea of a of taxing health care benefits or something like that. That's probably not the exact right language to use, but there's certainly some debate about this. This is getting to be kind of a real problem, I think, for the Democrats. If they can't get this done, and if the Republicans can paint this as a tax increase, they're going to have some serious problems in the 2010 elections, aren't they?
Sure, absolutely, and I think you know that there is a great political risk for the Democrats, because if they do decide to, and I think what they're talking about taxing would be what they call the Cadillac healthcare plans. You know, if you have a really great healthcare plan that provides, you know, a significant value to you in addition to your income, taxing, you know, the particularly exorbitant healthcare plans, the ones that most Americans don't have access to, if they end up doing that and then don't deliver on a new healthcare system that, you know, really does work better for people, then I think voters will likely hold it against them. So the question is, you know, will the decreased costs that the Democrats are arguing will come from their healthcare reform measures and this increased competition from a private plan, will those decreased costs make up for the increased costs that might result from a tax increase on the really high-end private insurance plans? And I think the question is going to be if the plan that they ultimately pass doesn't deliver what Democrats claim it will deliver, that's, I think, where the real political risk for them lies. So it's going to be a question of trying to figure out a way to pay for it while convincing people that it's, you know, that they're going to get their money's worth. And, you know, a lot of people, having had experience with government programs in the past, might be a little too skeptical to go along with the tax increase before they see what they're going to get.
So the health care is a big deal, and it's interesting to me, though, if you're going to tax the health care benefits of people who have good plans, it seems to me then that if they have to start actually paying their own premiums, as is probably going to be the case for a lot of state employees around the country, that they ought to be able to deduct that those health insurance premiums from their income taxes. But we'll just, I guess, have to see how they actually come up with something. We have a caller on the line who wants to actually talk about something we've just mentioned a little bit ago. Let's take a call from Rick in Superior and see what he has to say. Rick, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I would like to know if there should be some concern about Mark Sanford, the possibility of him sharing state secrets during this extramarital affair with a foreign national.
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what state secrets Governor Sanford may have been privy to. But I, to be honest, hadn't heard those allegations before. You know, that there were certainly allegations that he may have used state resources, or at least asked his, you know, state-paid staff to help him keep his secret. But beyond that, you know, I'm not sure that Governor Sanford really had any state secrets to give. So I hadn't heard that allegation, to be honest. The woman whom he was accused of having an affair with, It does not appear that she was any sort of government operative on behalf of the government of Argentina or anything like that. So I would, you know, to be honest, find that somewhat hard to believe. I hadn't heard those allegations before.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion here on all things political. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. House of Representatives passed some climate change legislation last Friday. It was a very close vote. considered a victory for the Obama administration. Depending on whose side you were on, this is either cap and trade or cap and tax. Warren Buffett is calling it a huge tax increase, while Paul Krugman points out that the bill contains market incentives to push people away from bad energy choices. So I wondered, I guess from the political, leaving aside the environmental concerns, the political concerns here are numerous. And let's talk about those for a little bit. What's the risk here for the Democrats? And what's the risk for the Republicans who haven't really put forward any energy policy of their own?
Sure. Well, I think the risks go both ways. So that's a well-phrased question. I think the rural conservative Democrats won a pretty major victory earlier last week when they convinced the sponsors of the bill to support changing the enforcement for agricultural carbon offsets from the Environmental Protection Agency to USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That was seen as a major victory for the more conservative Democrats. And I think it will go a long way towards persuading those of us who live in rural states that this new cap and trade system is worth, you know, buying into and worth cooperating with. I think there are a lot of folks out here who are just a bit skeptical of when the EPA tells them what they can and can't do. Whereas, you know, we've been working with USDA for so long that, we just may be more willing to go along with what the folks at USDA have to say when they're telling us, you know, we have to use this type of fertilizer on our farm or we'll end up getting, you know, charged a higher fee for carbon offsets, that sort of thing. So I think that helps to mitigate a bit of the potential shock that could have come from, you know, rural Americans who are a little bit uncomfortable or a little bit skeptical about this whole cap and trade thing, since it's a pretty unfamiliar idea to us. That said, of course, you know, depending on how much this really increases costs for utility companies, and there's some evidence to suggest that the states in the middle of the country will end up paying more in additional costs because of this than the coastal states, simply because states in the middle of the country seem to get more of their energy from coal power, and, you know, that has a higher carbon footprint. Depending on that sort of regional disparity, it could emerge that, you know, this ends up being a tax on the Midwest to benefit the folks on the East and the West coasts of the United States. And if that happens, then, you know, who knows what might happen politically, but it could end up hurting all the incumbents who voted for it, Republican or Democrat. Of course, the Republicans, as you said, you know, they didn't quite have their own plan, really. Many Republicans, actually, who signed on to, you know, older, maybe less robust cap-and-trade plans in past years, for instance, the Lieberman bill last year, did not sign on to this bill. And, you know, it's going to be hard to see, you know, how they make that distinction on the campaign trail. But again, I think, you know, time will tell how big a dent this new bill makes in the wallets of people across the country and what sorts of benefits, you know, we gain. If it ends up creating the jobs that Democrats claim that it will create, and they're talking somewhere around 2.5 million jobs across the country in new, what they call green-collar jobs, if that happens and it's noticeable to everyday Americans, then, you know, that will likely convince at least some folks that the additional $5 a month on their power bill was worth it.
Experiencing technical difficulties, please stand by. We hope to have John Munson and his guest back on very shortly here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, we apologize for our technical problems that we've had this morning. The fancier they make the plumbing, the easier it is to stump up the drains, as Commander Scott once said. We are talking about all things political in this first hour of the program, and my guest is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Before things went to someplace in a handbasket, we were going to talk to Ron in Onalaska. Let's see if we can do that without blowing up some portion of Milwaukee. Ron, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. Back to health care. I guess his comment on the tax on Cadillac plans for health insurance, well, I should be concerned that all our congressmen and legislators and presidents and whatnot are going to have to pay tax on a premium. Get real. Why would I be concerned about the Cadillac plan? Of course, they'll figure out a way to exempt themselves out. Also, what concerns me about health care is, as you know, I'm from Onalaska, I don't see any problem with building new medical facilities and doing continuous construction. My question is, where are all our health care dollars going? Nobody's looking. It's the gate is still open, and nobody cares. That's my comment.
Thanks, and, Ron. Chase?
Well, yeah, and I think that's actually an important point to make, one that the Democrats who are in favor of this new health care reform move are making themselves, and that is that there's just a lot of unaccounted for money moving its way through the system because of the way the incentives are currently set up with the private insurance plans, and especially perhaps with the way Medicare works now. Doctors are encouraged to administer tests that may or may not be necessary because insurance will pay for them, and to not administer other tests that may be useful because insurance won't pay for them. And, it does not seem like those practices are always in line with what the doctors themselves would consider the best.
Well, doctors are complaining that they spend way too much of their time arguing with insurance company bureaucrats over what care they can give their patients. And that's one of their issues. Meanwhile, some estimates are that the administrative costs for our health care system run as high as 35%. So, Ron's question is a good one. Where is all the money going? Why isn't it producing more health care? The facts remain that we may have the most expensive health care system in the world, but clearly there are some people who are not able to get access to it. And that's kind of the debate. How do we do that, and how can we afford it? So
exactly. The folks who support a public plan point to the fact that the private insurance companies, as you said, have about 35% of their revenue going to administrative costs, and public systems like Medicare typically pay more like 12%, one of the lowest rates of administrative costs in the industry. So, they argue that that's a way to get some of that unaccounted for money back. It's one of those complex problems that I'm sure there are a lot of different ways that money is getting skimmed off right now, but it has the effect in the end of raising costs for everyone, and no one seems to really benefit from it. No one, not even the hospitals or the doctors or the insurance companies, are really thrilled with the way it works right now. So it's hard to find someone who actually says the system is really good.
let's go to Mike Racine next. Mike, good morning.
Hi. Actually, my call is kind of a segue from the last caller, continue on. Is I'm having some difficulty understanding the math that's being done. Some of the detractors from the proposed health plan are continuously throwing out these numbers, which I'm having a hard time understanding. Are these the cost only what the government's kicking in, or is that a holistic cost estimate based on if the government comes in and does some of these public plans, then there's going to be a displacement on corresponding plans in the insurance area and so forth. So I kind of think that some of the detractors are only talking about the cost to the government, but they're not acknowledging that there's going to be savings elsewhere in the process.
And that is true. These numbers that come out of the Congressional Budget Office and the Government Accounting Office, those numbers do talk about the fiscal impact on the government's bottom line. So they do not account for the potential cost savings that supporters of the plan argue will be in place pretty much as soon as the public plan goes into effect. nor, for that matter, do they take into account the arguments that supporters of this health care reform plan make, the arguments that they make that, you know, over time this will essentially prevent the United States economy from imploding on itself because of increasing health care costs. You know, that there's the argument that no matter what it costs, you know, the United States economy just can't afford to continue paying increased health care premiums that are increasing at so far beyond the rate of inflation that, you know, that you could make an argument that the big three automakers were in large part forced into bankruptcy or close to bankruptcy because of, you know, the legacy costs that they've had to pay in health care to their former employees and their current employees. And if, you know, if Ford and GM and Chrysler didn't have to compete against companies from Japan and Germany who, you know, where they have essentially socialized medicine, where the government is taking care of the health care costs so that the companies aren't responsible for them, then perhaps they would have been in a better place to compete already. You know, so there's that argument, too, that just the economic benefit of having a government-administered public health care plan to lower costs for everyone will help to save the U.S. economy. You know, it's hard to really put a number on that, but there are folks who argue that the benefits of that outweigh whatever potential cost the government might incur having this public plan.
And you, a mayor in a city in Wisconsin pointed out to me what cities are paying for health care for their employees, and how much money they would save if the government got this, if the federal government was able to achieve some meaningful health care reform. You know, we're talking about potential savings for local units of government here that are pretty significant, and they're another body that taxes people. So, you know, you may pay it in one place and get it back in another. No one really knows how this is all going to work out, but it's a pretty complicated issue. Let's we'll take a couple more calls on health care, and then I'd like to move on because there are some interesting international issues and some other political stuff to talk about as well. Let's go to Dave and first, and then Mike and Portage after that. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I know you could spend hours and days on health care.
And we have.
I just fear that we're never going to get reform that's going to work, because it's any reform, if you're trying to incorporate the failures of our current, quote, system, is like putting lipstick on a Vega. You just can't take a Chevy Vega from 1972 and just add new tires. And so any reform is going to be the naysayers who say it's going to be add cost to the system and everything else are probably going to be right, because we're not attacking the fundamental gross problems with the system, which is overcapacity and cost shifting and a lot of the things that make other countries more efficient. There's no reason why this country spends twice as much as most other countries and gets the lousy results that we get. They're doing something right. We're doing it wrong, and our system is not capable of being reformed. It has to be torn down.
I've certainly heard that argument made before, you know, from people who support what they call the single-payer healthcare plan, you know, where private insurance would essentially have no role or a very small role in insuring people, and the vast majority of people would get their insurance straight from the government through, you know, a plan like Medicare that would be expanded to cover everyone. Of course, the Democrats argue, even the Democrats who might be sympathetic to that plan argue that it's just politically infeasible right now to get that sort of a plan passed.
Yeah, but nobody's ever explained why that is.
Sure. Well, you know, I think in large part they may be afraid simply based on the failures from the early 90s where they went up against the insurance companies, and the insurance companies essentially won by running, you know, by spending millions of dollars on advertisements across the country. You know, whether or not they're right to be afraid of that happening again, you know, that's above my pay grade to answer that question too. But you know, the president's advisors have argued that, you know, if it's true that a public plan, that a single payer plan, is so much better than private insurance, then setting up what is essentially a single payer plan as one option, you know, among many, should eventually lead to a single-payer system. You know, if private insurance companies really just aren't capable of being as efficient or as effective at getting people treatment as a public plan is, then perhaps people will simply stop using the private plans. You know, if the public plan remains cheaper and covers more things than the private plans, you know, over time perhaps America will move closer and closer to a what is essentially a single-payer system. But, you know, the premise of the whole argument behind having simply a public option rather than, you know, basically mandating that everyone use a government insurance plan is that in the United States, a free market or at least some form of competition is better than, you know, mandating things. That's true from a political perspective, and many believe that, it's true also just from a pure economic perspective.
Of course, the Republicans argue that the public plan wouldn't, that the private insurance carriers wouldn't be able to compete with a public plan because it wouldn't have some of their issues, and they're basically saying this would run them out of business. You know, that would, I guess the only way to find that out would be to put it in place. Let's take one more call here, and then we're going to switch issues here. Mike in Portage, you get the last word on health care.
Hi. First, just a general comment. In many political things that are important, I think there's a moral imperative. Health care for everyone in this country, concern for the environment and global warming. And these things, to me, have a moral imperative. And so it just amazes me that people squawk about the fact that it's going to cost us more money. How it costs us more money is a worthwhile debate. How you keep the cost down is a worthwhile debate. But that it's going to cost us more is kind of a no-brainer. And because it's a moral imperative, it's something we got to live with. But on the two other matters that are maybe more practical to talk about, one of the things that I hear people complain about is fraud. And I'd like to see something included in healthcare reform where there's a nationwide database of individuals who were involved in fraud and have them banned for life from any of the industries that they participated in knowingly or saw fraud and didn't step forward. I'd like a comment on feasibility of something like that. Just banning corporations and individuals permanently from the from that business if they knowingly allow fraud.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the simple answer is, you know, we do already have at least some laws on the books against insurance fraud. Whether or not they need to be strengthened, you know, I think is another question, and I don't think you'll get much argument from me out of that. They certainly do need to be strengthened, but at the same time, it's hard to say that an entire company is responsible for what the company would argue is, you know, one bad apple or, you know, one bad claims adjuster or, you know, one bad caseworker. You know, they'll argue that if you convict an individual for committing insurance fraud, that individual will never work in insurance again. You know, that's not a very hard thing to accomplish under the current system already. You know, it's a question of how far you go to enforce it against the companies that those individuals worked for. And then on the other side, for the individuals who commit the fraud, you know, the customers of the insurance companies who file false claims and that sort of thing, you know, do you deny them insurance coverage in the future simply because they made a mistake in the past? And that, I think, would then go back to the moral question that you raised first, that, you know, we really can't be in the business of telling someone they can't have health care coverage. So, you know, everyone, regardless of what they've done in the past, will have to be allowed into the system on some level. You know, perhaps we need to strengthen the monitoring to prevent fraud, and perhaps we need to do more to deter it at the corporate level. But, you know, at a certain level, everyone's going to have to be allowed to be involved in this system in some way, or else it's not going to prevent the problem that we're currently experiencing, which is just millions of Americans who don't have insurance, and, you know, that's driving up costs for the rest of us.
It's All Things Political on this Monday morning, the 29th of June. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. My guest this hour is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. And we have open lines for you if you want to call right now. Lots of chances for you to talk about political news. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about President Obama and the media, and we're also going to talk about North Korea, Honduras, lots of other political news to discuss. We'll be right back I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network. Okay, the gremlins are active in the machinery today. Stay tuned next hour. We're going to talk about one of the most beloved works of English literature combined with zombies, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, a new book just out. And we'll talk with one of the authors. The other one, would have to be a zombie herself in order to be on the air. Let's see. Sometimes it seems like the political news is being dominated by zombies, but not today. We're talking about all things political. My guest is Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. Let's take a look at, there was one of the things that came up in the Sunday morning talk shows was President Obama's love affair or the love affair of the mainstream media with President Obama. He seems to be getting along pretty well with the press. They really like him.
Sure, absolutely, and that is obviously, you know, that started on the campaign trail back before he was really even a serious contender. I think, the media saw him as what was essentially a really great news story, and you know, it turned out they were right, perhaps based on their own actions and perhaps based on, you know, simply the trajectory of the country. It emerged into a very, very compelling news story, you know, one that raised the ratings for the evening newscast for about a year, increased newspaper web traffic, and you know, just seemed to breathe new life into a journalism community that was at that point feeling pretty depressed and unsure about the future of their profession. Not that President Obama alone, you know, is really going to save the newspaper industry or anything like that, but you know, it was a good story that helped sell a lot of magazines and a lot of newspapers, and that's why to this day you see his face on the cover a lot. A lot more than you saw President Bush's face on the cover of magazines towards the end of his presidency. It just seems that when a president is very popular, the media tends to take advantage of that, perhaps inflating his popularity, but also just simply to increase their bottom line and sell more papers and magazines.
Okay, well, let's move on to some international issues next. North Koreans making a lot of noise. This is another hot potato in foreign policy that no recent president has really been able to deal with all that effectively. From the political perspective, how big a deal is the North Korean situation?
Sure. Well, you know, I think in a broader sense, we now know that the conventional wisdom is true that, you know, when a new president takes over, a lot of people step up and try to test him. We've seen President Obama facing a lot of international crises that are tough to deal with, and that, you know, if the American people saw coming a year ago, they might have even had second thoughts about electing a president with as little experience as President Obama had. That said, you know, the North Korea conflict is obviously one of the toughest to deal with, in large part because there are a lot of things going on beneath the surface, negotiating for the release of the two hostages, or I guess not hostages, the two prisoners, the American journalists who were over there, and that sort of thing. You know, it seems like North Korea is the one country that we really just can't get a handle on. That we just don't quite understand the motivations of behind the scenes. You know, with Iran, there's a glimmer of hope right now with the more moderate reformist movement that's happening within the country. But in Iran, you know, we hear very little about what's going on there. And, you know, it doesn't seem at this point like President Obama's policy towards North Korea is going to be much different from the Bush administration's policy or, even the Clinton administration's policy. At this point, we don't have a whole lot of evidence to suggest that the threats from North Korea that on July 4th they're going to launch a missile at Hawaii, that those are any more credible than the previous threats that they've made. But obviously those sorts of threats are troubling. And couple that with the potential of there being that ship full of weapons going to Myanmar right now, that we're not sure what we're going to do about, in terms of international law. There are a lot of implications that, are just troubling, but it's really unclear at this point what the United States should do or what the United States can do. The president has made a point of saying that the United States is no longer going to be sort of the world's policeman and that we won't insert ourselves into matters that, our presence will simply make worse. Whether this is one of those matters, again, is unclear. But obviously, any country that's making threats against the United States, whether they're credible threats or not, that's very troubling and not very good for our national security interests to just let go idly by.
Let's take a call from Tim in Ladysmith next.
Tim,
good morning.
A couple of points. First of all, you're just talking about North Korea, and your guest had mentioned the president seems to have the policy that we're not going to be the policeman of the world. I guess my question is, well, who is going to be the policeman of the world? Obviously, the UN is worthless, and they're always silent on what really matters. So secondly, I think the press has given this president a free ride, and it's a great disservice to our country. I mean, some of the things that this president is basically doing, I would call them socialist. Socialist takeover of financial institutes, car companies, so on and so forth. And the press just seems to be mood on it. They love him so much because he's one of theirs, and I think it's pathetic. And anyhow, I'll take my comments off the air.
Sure. Well,
all right, thanks for the call.
I think when it comes to at least the allegations of socialism with what the president has done with the car companies and with the bank bailouts and all that, I think it's fair to say that the Bush administration, kicked off these policies. Whether they would have bailed out the auto industry in the same way that they bailed out the banks, remains unclear. But they were the ones who first came up with this idea of, massive infusions of cash for the financial services industry. And even the free traders and the very economic conservatives who have worked with the Obama administration on these plans, that they ask simply, what would you have done? I think we saw what was essentially a failure of market capitalism, not because the whole philosophy behind it is flawed, simply because there were a few too bad apples and there weren't enough regulations being enforced. But that led to a crisis that the government felt it needed to step in and prevent, or it would have been much, much worse and, perhaps permanently damaging to the United States economy. So, well, it's certainly true that, the Obama administration has had a much bigger hand in, the American economy than most recent presidencies. Their question is, what else would we have done besides this to avert this crisis?
It's clear that
whether we're really averting it at all. But
it's pretty clear that the financial regulators were the referees had been taken off the field more or less. There hasn't been really any oversight of the system for a long time. I think everybody would have to agree about that. Look at how the Bernie Madoff. There were people complaining that this guy was running a Ponzi scheme for years, and no one ever bothered to even investigate it. You had a lot of that going on, too. And when you take all the referees off the field and you let the both teams call their own penalties, then you're not going to get very many penalties called. Let's take a call from Ed in Wausau.
Hi. I'd just like to respond to your fellow from the Iowa Independent in that they're saying Obama got a free ride. I vaguely remember Bush, when he was in Florida, reading kids' books while airplanes were going into the buildings in New York. And I think if anyone got a free ride in the press, it was Bush. And we ended up, even though every one of those hijackers in the planes had Saudi Arabia passports. Bush even let the only plane that was flying around the U.S. picking up people bound for Saudi Arabia was a plane that was approved by Bush. But I think the press just gave President Bush such a ride that we ended up in an illegal war in Iraq. That's my only comment.
Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it. Let's go to... Well, let's talk a little bit about the you mentioned, and I think our caller mentioned Iran. We have the government conducting a partial recount in an effort to appease the protesters. President Ahmadinejad is calling for an investigation into the death of the woman now known only as Nida, who has become a symbol of those protests. The Iranians have seized nine members, I think it was, of the British embassy. I believe those were Iranian nationals, and the Iranian government still blames the U.S. and Britain, particularly the BBC, for the unrest in their country. President Obama has been criticized by some for not saying enough and by others for saying too much. What's the political fallout here?
Sure. Well, you know, I think fairly or unfairly, the president will be judged based on what ends up happening in Iran. You know, the president has made as clear as he can that he feels his hands are pretty much tied, that any American involvement or even just the perception of American involvement in this conflict in Iran, would do significant damage to the reform movement there. But at the same time, you know, if Iran devolves into essentially a hostile nuclear power, hell-bent on destroying us, he will be held accountable for not having done more to support the reform movement while he had this chance. At the same time, of course, he'll argue that he didn't really have much of a choice, that there wasn't a whole lot that he could do, and based on the arguments that Ahmadinejad and his supporters are making already, that, you know, this whole reform movement was really just a ploy from Great Britain and the United States, that, you know, obviously that sort of argument is very effective in politics in Iran, and the United States needs to guard very carefully against that sort of perception. But I think it's safe to say in terms of politics that President Obama will probably be held accountable for what happens there, whether or not he really could have done anything to change the outcome of the election. And at this point, you know, I think most people assume that this recount and this investigation, is not likely to change the result of the election or result in any significant changes, but that the more promising, chances for changing and reforming Iranian society are simply by pressuring the Ahmadinejad government and the supreme leader to institute more reforms based on all this unrest to try to quell it. But I don't think anyone at this point expects the election to be overturned. Most people assume that, you know, short of a revolution or some kind of, coup, that Ahmadinejad will remain in power, for the foreseeable future in Iran. And knowing that, you know, then President Obama's objectives become not simply supporting the reform movement in Iran, but being on reasonable enough terms with the current Iranian government to help, you know, negotiate away from getting their nuclear arms. So, you know, he has very complicated questions to answer, but perhaps he's in that position where he's going to get blamed for what happens, even though he doesn't really have a whole lot of control over it.
Meanwhile, political turmoil in Honduras, a little bit closer to home than Iran. The president ousted by the military on the day that there was a referendum about holding a referendum. That whole situation was kind of confusing. The United States, I believe Hillary Clinton is involved now in trying to figure out what's going on down there. Again, every time this is a world in turmoil, you've got hotspots all over the place. It's a tough time for the president and his administration because he's trying to focus on his domestic issues. And meanwhile, we've got all these things happening around the world that we need to be at least looking into.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, the potential there for conflict is a bit scary. We're only just really learning what could happen there. But we know that Hugo Chavez has his military in Venezuela on high alert because this president, who happened to be an ally of Chavez, he was one of the more leftist leaders in South America. He's been ousted, and Chavez feels that as a threat to Venezuela. It remains to be seen what's going to happen. Obviously, what was happening was that the president was trying to run for a second term, even though Honduras, you know, having lived through dictatorships around it for many years, term limited its presidents at one term. You know, he was going to seek a second term, or at least he was going to try to see if he had the public support for a second term by holding a referendum to determine that. And the military felt too threatened and decided that it was, you know, time for him to go.
We're just about out of time, so we can't take any more calls. Make a prediction. What's going to be the big political story that breaks this week? What do you think?
Sure. Well, you know, I think, to be honest, as morbid as it may sound, Governor Mark Sanford got a bit of a break with the high-profile celebrity deaths that happened late last week. That took his face off the front page. But I do think that because there are still so many questions about, you know, who the woman whom Governor Sanford was having his affair with is, and the details about, you know, how he may have used state resources to travel to Argentina and that sort of thing, I think that's going to be a story that reporters see as a gift that keeps on giving. Plus, you know, we're entering this final week where we could find out the fate of a public option healthcare plan. I think that's going to be a big question as well.
All right. And we're out of time. Thank you so much, Chase Martin, for joining us. Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and on-air production by Jolena Noel. We'll be back to talk about zombies and Jane Austen in just a bit. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.